Welcome. So now, tonight I think we'll finish our reading of this wonderful chapter, Gnosis and Ananda. Sri Aurobindo, when we were in those last paragraphs that we covered last week, described how, as the soul rising through the gnosis, approaching the plane of Ananda itself, loses in a sense its distinctness. It isn't that it comes not to be, but that here, in this plane, there's an insistence on infinity, on what is transcendent, what is universal. So we take up that theme and recognize that this voluntary limitation which Chit Shakti imposes on its own being at the plane of Vijnana surrenders itself into centerless existence in the plane of bliss. We have occasion almost at once to note some placements of these inner geographies, the conscious cartography that Sri Aurobindo is alluding to in all of this, going back in time, thousands of years, hundreds of years. So we start with this wonderful sentence. The soul lives. It is not abolished. It is not lost in a featureless indefinite. This is contra the end of the road as described by Advaita Vedanta, as described by Buddhism, in which there is an extinction of being in an unnameable something, but a blowing out of individuality. Sri Aurobindo states that the soul is not abolished. Your individuality, even on the supremest plane, is not struck. You continue. You persist. For on every plane of our existence, the same principle holds. The soul may fall asleep in a trance of self-absorption, dwell in an ineffable intensity of God possession, live in the highest glory of its own plane. The Anandaloka, Brahmaloka, Vaikuntha, Goloka, various Indian systems, even turn upon the lower worlds to fill them with its own light and power and beatitude. In the eternal worlds, and more in all worlds above mind, these states exist in each other. For they are not separate. They are coexistent, even coincident powers of the consciousness of the Absolute. Here separable, here experienced differently, blended in an obscure mixture that we can hardly discriminate. But as we rise and the power of consciousness grows one with the power of will, unity is enforced. The divine on the Ananda plane is not incapable of a world play or self-debarred from any expression of its glories. This goes to Taittiriya Upanishad, third chapter, sixth verse. On the contrary, as the Upanishad insists, the Ananda is the true creative principle. For all takes birth from this divine bliss. All is pre-existent in it as an absolute truth of existence, which the Vijnana brings out and subjects to voluntary limitation by the idea and the law of the idea. So let's pause for a moment. The Ananda plane. First, the footnote. Therefore, the world of the Ananda is called the Janaloka, in the double sense of birth and delight. Now, Sri Aurobindo is probably here referring to his favorite of all the Puranas, the Vishnu Purana, and this would be in Book 2, Chapter 7, where there is described the sevenfold world order. At the base is Bhurloka, the earth, then Bhuvarloka, which leads all the way up to the level of the sun, sort of the interstices between. There, when come to Svarloka, the world of the gods, where Dhruva is, above Maharloka, the world of the vast, Janaloka, the world of delight, Tapoloka, where tapas, the supreme, pressing itself together, creates the force that leads Ananta to distribute itself in the lower planes. Finally, the seventh and the highest plane is Satya Loka. So that's the world of truth. Loka means world. So Satya, Tapo, Jana, Mahar, etc., all the way down to the earth plane. So Jana Loka would correspond to the plane of delight as described in the Taittiriya Upanishad. We should also note that in the Rig Veda, in the ninth book, the 113th hymn, in the sixth and also in the seventh verse, there is the idea that Soma brings forth delight. Pursuing the ritual Soma as the person who offers sacrifice, that brings you into contact with emerging delight. So the act of the giving, the intentional pursuit, ordinating all the being, not simply in the ritual act, but then taking the lessons gained from that into the whole of one's existence. No better place to practice yoga than at home and at work. Then delight begins to flow. So we have allusions in the Rig Veda, in the Taittiriya Upanishad clearly, and in the Puranas. Probably the oldest is the Vishnu Purana. So the Supreme Existence expresses itself through overflowing delight. In the distribution of its infinity in coordinated harmonic form through what we call Vijnana, this vast truth consciousness, which has an idea, but not a flimsy idea, but a real idea that establishes the law of its being, Ritam. So now Sri Aurobindo continues. In the Ananda, all law ceases, and there is an absolute freedom without binding term or limit. It is superior to all principles and in one and the same motion, the enjoyer of all principles. It is free from all gunas and the enjoyer of its own infinite gunas, whatever quality it applies to itself, whatever form or force it chooses to take. It does it freely, it is not compelled. It selects spontaneously, automatically. It is above all forms, and the builder and enjoyer of all its self forms and figures. This is redolent of the passages sometimes in the Gita and sometimes in Sri Lalita Sahasranam. She becomes all this and yet is free of it. She's all the gunas, but she's free of all the gunas. Nothing can imprison her infinite experience. Everything expresses some part of it, some particle of her being. Nothing captures her fully. Only herself is she, the full. Purnam. This unimaginable completeness is what the Spirit is. The Spirit transcendent and universal. And to be one in bliss with the transcendent and universal Spirit is for the soul too to be that and nothing less. Necessarily, since there is on this plane the absolute and the play of absolutes, it is ineffable by any of the conceptions of our mind or by signs of the phenomenal or ideal realities of which mind conceptions are the figures in our intelligence. So you remember that passage from the Taittiriya. The mind falls back from that, baffled, unattaining. This is what the term ineffable connotes. You cannot speak it. From the Latin, ineffabilis. What cannot be spoken, what cannot be described. It is too immense to be captured in a phrase. No form can communicate it entirely. Every form, in a sense, conveys something, and if you take the key, the link, the thread, and follow it, you get all the way back to the entire fabric. But nothing can speak it all at once. The limits of language are too painfully evident. These realities are themselves indeed only relative symbols of those ineffable absolutes. The symbol, the expressive reality, may give an idea of perception, sense, vision, contact, even of the thing itself to us, but at last we get beyond it to the thing it symbolizes, transcend idea, vision, contact, pierce through the ideal and pass to the real realities, the identical, the supreme, the timeless and eternal, the infinitely infinite. Our first absorbing impulse, when we become inwardly aware of something entirely beyond what we now are and know and are powerfully attracted to it, is to get away from the present actuality and dwell in that higher reality altogether. This is that movement of spiritual exclusivism, you know, that leads us down the path of renunciation. Let me experience only that. I want nothing to do with this here in the time-bound field. The extreme form of this attraction, when we are drawn to the supreme existence and the infinite ananda, is the condemnation of the lower and the finite as an illusion and an aspiration to nirvana in the beyond. The passion for dissolution, immersion, extinction in the spirit. So here we are many chapters into the synthesis of yoga, and he's bringing us back in a sense to the theme of the second chapter in the Life Divine. we cannot afford to be spiritual if it means excluding the manifestation. That is not our goal. We are here to integrate, to make one, to fulfill, to unify. But the real dissolution, the true nirvana, is the release of all that is bindingly characteristic of the lower into the larger being of the higher, the conscious possession of the living symbol by the living real. We discover in the end that not only is that higher reality the cause of all the rest, not only it embraces and exists in all the rest, but as more and more we possess it, all this rest is transformed in our soul experience into the superior value and becomes the means of a richer expression of the real, a more many-sided communion with the infinite, a larger ascent to the supreme. This again goes back to Taittiriya Upanishad, the third chapter, the sixth section therein. Finally, we get close to the Absolute and its supreme values, which are the absolutes of all things. We lose the passion for release, mumukshutva, which till then actuated us, because we are now intimately near to that which is ever free, that which is neither attracted into attachment by what binds us now, nor afraid of what to us seems to be bondage. It is only by the loss of the bound soul's exclusive passion for its freedom that there can come an absolute liberation of our nature. The divine attracts the soul of man to him by various lures. All of them are born of its own relative and imperfect conceptions of bliss. All are its ways of seeking for the Ananda, but if clung to till the end, miss the inexpressible truth of those surpassing felicities. First in order comes the lure of an earthly reward, a prize of material, intellectual, ethical, or other joy in the terrestrial mind and body. A second, remoter, greater version of the same fruitful error is the hope of a heavenly bliss, far exceeding these earthly rewards. The conception of heaven rises in altitude and purity till it reaches the pure idea of the eternal presence of God, or an unending union with the eternal. At last, we get the subtlest of all lures, an escape from these worldly or heavenly joys and from all pains and sorrows, effort and trouble, and from all phenomenal things, in nirvana, a self-dissolution in the absolute, an ananda of cessation and ineffable peace. In the end, all these toys of the mind have to be transcended. So, rewards and heavens in the blissful immersion into nothingness, these things do not satisfy ultimately. Sri Aurobindo, of course, was never attracted to the first two, but his first shattering spiritual experience and realization was that of nirvana into Brahman, not the annihilation of being, but the absorption of his being into the whole, into the only thing that is, which makes the world seem phantasmagorial. And so he could see it, but he grew beyond that and had an even mightier realization only months later, in which he found not simply the vacancy of personal being, but the fulfillment of all being, universal, transcendent, individual, in the disclosure of the personal divine who is omnipresent. This was at the key to his integral yoga. Had he not had that experience, it would have been like the classic escape from the world that many seekers have had. But for two things. First, he never quit working, even in that mighty experience of nirvana. He continued to work. Huh. And in working, he was practicing loka sangraha, the holding together of the worlds in this mighty experience. And it led towards this greater disclosure when Krishna plucked him from the field of politics and said, "May I have a word?" So this is Sri Aurobindo speaking again in panegyric phraseology about something that was intimate to him. The fear of birth and the desire of escape from birth must entirely fall away from us. For to repeat the ancient language, the soul that has realized oneness has no sorrow or shrinking. The spirit that has entered into the bliss of the spirit has naught to fear from anyone or anything whatsoever. Fear, desire, and sorrow are diseases of the mind, born of its sense of division and limitation. They seize with the falsehood that begot them. The Ananda is free from these maladies. It is not the monopoly of the ascetic. It is not born from the disgust of existence. So since he's referred us to the Isha Upanishad, let's read his own translation of verse 6 and verse 7. But he who sees everywhere the self in all existences, and all existences in the self, shrinks not thereafter from aught. He in whom it is the self-being that has become all existences that are becomings, for he has the perfect knowledge. How shall he be deluded? Whence shall he have grief who sees everywhere oneness? I'll go one step farther, the eighth. It is he that has gone abroad, that which is bright, bodiless, without scar of imperfection, without sinews, pure, unpierced by evil. The seer, the thinker, the one who becomes everywhere. The self-existent has ordered objects perfectly according to their nature from years sempiternal. So, I think we can calm ourselves. I think we can be at peace, do our work, grow in joy and felicity, leave our finitude behind, because it is simply a mask. It's a way we sign our presence in the universe. We are more than that. He continues. The bliss soul is not bound to birth or to non-birth. It is not driven by desire of the knowledge or harassed by fear of the ignorance. This is again Isha Upanishad. This is the 13th verse. The supreme bliss soul has already the knowledge and transcends all need of knowledge. Knowledge flows out of the one who lives in delight. Knowledge is an expression of chit shakti, which moves at the bidding of delight. Not limited in consciousness by the form and the act, it can play with the manifestation without being imbued with the ignorance. Already it is taking its part above in the mystery of an eternal manifestation, and here, when the time comes, it will descend into birth without being the slave of ignorance chained to the revolutions of the wheel of nature. Now, this is a deep secret of sadhana. This is a calling of the eternal jivatman to leave its spaces in eternity and descend itself and marry itself to the emerging soul consciousness here. When the jivatman rushes into the psychic being and they become one, ha, this is the seat, this is the asana of transformation. For it knows that the purpose and law of the birth series is for the soul and the body to rise from plane to plane and substitute always the rule of the higher for the rule of the lower plane, even down to the material field. And this is not simply a rising in height. This is a power of inclusion. The higher you rise, the more power you have to descend, to include, to incorporate, to embody, to embrace. The bliss soul neither disdains to help that ascent from above, nor fears to descend down the stairs of God into the material birth, and there contribute the power of its own bliss nature to the upward pull of the divine forces. The time for that marvelous hour of the eternal, I'll start again. The time for that marvelous hour of the evolving time spirit is not yet come. Man, generally, cannot yet ascend to the bliss nature. He has first to secure himself on the higher mental altitudes and to ascend from them to the gnosis. So first we must become true mental beings, become masters of the mental domain, a soul engaging with the lucidities of mind, and lift ourselves beyond the highest sphere of mind into the supermind, this Gnostic consciousness to which he refers here, and then, through long preparation, become equipped to experience and hold within us the experience of Ananda. Yes, the power of Ananda. Yes, the true being of Ananda. Still less can he bring down all the bliss power into this terrestrial nature. He must first cease to be mental man and become superhuman. All he can do now is to receive something of its power into his soul in greater or less degree by a diminishing transmission through an inferior consciousness. But even that gives him the sense of an ecstasy and an unsurpassable beatitude. And what will be the bliss nature when it manifests in a new supramental race? The fully evolved soul will be one with all beings in the status and dynamic effects of experience of a bliss consciousness intense and illimitable. So we see in the Life Divine, in those last six chapters, that he describes the Gnostic being and the divine life, but limits himself to the proposition of what will this supramental consciousness be capable of achieving and extending. Here, in the world as we meet it? How will it come into human society? How will it recreate society and self? The social self and the individual self. What impact will it have on the globe? What impact on the destiny of the evolving Earth? And, of course, it is instinct, the supramental consciousness, with the power, with the reality of delight. But Sri Aurobindo does not describe it fully, even in the life divine. So here, in 1932, as he writes this chapter, as he improves this chapter, he leaves much unexpressed, but refers to it here, suggestively, encouragingly. So let's read that beginning again. And what will be the bliss nature when it manifests in a new supramental race? The fully evolved soul will be one with all beings in the status and dynamic effects of experience of a bliss consciousness intense and illimitable. And since love is the effective power and soul symbol of bliss oneness, he will approach and enter into this oneness by the gate of universal love, a sublimation of human love at first, a divine love afterwards, at its summits, a thing of beauty, sweetness, and splendor, now to us inconceivable. He will be one in bliss consciousness with all the world play and its powers and happenings, and there will be banished forever the sorrow and fear, the hunger and pain of our poor and darkened mental and vital and physical existence. He puts behind us even the lingering shadows that we see populating spiritual texts like, yes, the Gita and all the annals of Buddhism. He sees a new chapter opening. These are the noons of the future that he calls us to. He will get that power of the bliss freedom in which all the conflicting principles of our being shall be unified in their absolute values. All evil shall perforce change itself into good. The universal beauty of the all-beautiful will take possession of its fallen kingdoms. Every darkness will be converted into a pregnant glory of light, and the discords which the mind creates between truth and good and beauty, power and love and knowledge, will disappear on the eternal summit in the infinite extensions where they are always one. Here, his masterstroke, the conversion of the opposites, integration perfected. The Purusha in mind, life, and body is divided from nature and in conflict with her. Purusha, Prakriti, separate here. He labors to control and coerce what he can embody of her by his masculine force, and is yet subject to her afflicting dualities, and in fact, her plaything from top to bottom, beginning to end. In the gnosis, he is biune with her. He, Purusha, she, Prakriti. In the gnosis, he is biune with her. Finds as master of his own nature their reconciliation and harmony by their essential oneness, even while he accepts an infinite blissful subjection, the condition of his mastery and his liberties to the supreme in his sovereign divine nature. Bayun, two in one. So, not Purusha Prakriti, more like Ishvara Shakti. in the tops of the gnosis and in the ananda. He is one with the Prakriti and no longer solely bayun with her. Ha! This is where Purushottama and Para Prakriti are the same. No difference. Or you could say Ishvara is Ishwari. Who is master of whom when all is one, when all are one, when there is only one? There is no longer the baffling play of nature with the soul and the ignorance. All is the conscious play of the soul with itself and all itself and the supreme, and the divine Shakti in its own, and the infinite bliss nature. This is the supreme mystery, the highest secret, simple to its own experience, however difficult and complex to our mental conceptions and the effort of our limited intelligence to understand what is beyond it. In the free infinity of the self-delight of Satchit-Ananda, there is a play of the divine child, a rasa-lila of the infinite lover, and its mystic soul symbols repeat themselves in characters of beauty and movements and harmonies of delight in a timeless forever. This reminds us of Sri Aurobindo's sixth chapter in The Mother. He's describing Mahalakshmi here. Admitted to the heart, she lifts wisdom to pinnacles of wonder and reveals to it the mystic secrets of the ecstasy that surpasses all knowledge, meets devotion with the passionate attraction of the divine, teaches to strength and force the rhythm that keeps the might of their acts harmonious and in measure, and casts on perfection the charm that makes it endure forever. And just pages ago, we were reading in this very chapter a section that reminded us of his Thoughts and Glimpses, which saw publication on 15 May 1915. What is God, after all? An eternal child playing an eternal game in an eternal garden. In the free infinity of the self-delight of Satchit-Ananda, there is a play of the divine child, a rasa-lila of the infinite lover, and its mystic soul symbols repeat themselves in characters of beauty and movements and harmonies of delight in a timeless forever. Some things are worth reading twice. And if you'll permit me to read to you a section from Savitri, I think we've had occasion to read this before. Let's read this again, too. This is Savitri, Book 7, the Book of Yoga. Canto 7, the Cosmic Spirit and Cosmic Consciousness. And we'll start on page 554, towards the bottom. But now she sat by sleeping Satyavan, awake within, and the enormous night surrounded her with the unknowables vast. A voice began to speak from her own heart that was not hers, yet mastered thought and sense. As it spoke, all changed within her and without. All was, all lived. She felt all being one. The world of unreality ceased to be. There was no more a universe built by mind, convicted as a structure or a sign. A spirit, a being, saw created things and cast itself into unnumbered forms and was what it saw and made. All now became an evidence of one stupendous truth, a truth in which negation had no place, a being and a living consciousness, a stark and absolute reality. There the unreal could not find a place. The sense of unreality was slain. There, all was conscious, made of the infinite. All had a substance of eternity. Yet this was the same indecipherable. It seemed to cast from it universe like a dream, vanishing forever into an original void. But this was no more some vague, ubiquitous point or a cipher of vastness and unreal naught. It was the same, but now no more seemed far to the living clasp of her recovered soul. It was herself. It was the self of all. It was the reality of existing things. It was the consciousness of all that lived and felt and saw. It was timelessness and time. It was the bliss of formlessness and form. It was all love and the one beloved's arms. It was sight and thought in one all-seeing mind. It was joy of being on the peaks of God. She passed beyond time into eternity, slipped out of space, and became the infinite. Her being rose into unreachable heights and found no end of its journey in the cell. It plunged into the unfathomable deeps and found no end to the silent mystery that held all world within one lonely breast, yet harbored all creation's multitudes. She was all vastness and one measureless point. She was a height beyond heights, a depth beyond depths. She lived in the everlasting and was all that harbors death and bears the wheeling hours. All contraries were true in one huge spirit, surpassing measure, change, and circumstance. An individual, one with cosmic self, in the heart of the transcendence miracle, and the secret of world personality, was the creator and the lord of all. Mind was a single, innumerable look upon himself in all that he became. Life was his drama, and the vast a stage. The universe was his body, God its soul. All was one single, immense reality, all its innumerable phenomenon. Her spirit saw the world as living God. It saw the One and knew that all was He. She knew Him as the absolute self-space, one with herself and ground of all things here, in which the world wanders seeking for the truth, guarded behind its face of ignorance. She followed Him through the march of endless time. All nature's happenings were events in her. The heartbeats of the cosmos were her own. All beings thought and felt and moved in her. She inhabited the vastness of the world. Its distances were her nature's boundaries. Its closenesses, her own life's intimacies. Her mind became familiar with its mind. Its body was her body's larger frame in which she lived and knew herself in it one, multitudinous in its multitudes. She was a single being, yet all things. The world was her spirit's wide circumference. The thoughts of others were her intimates, their feelings close to her universal heart, their bodies, her many bodies, kin to her. She was no more herself, but all the world. Out of the infinitudes all came to her. Into the infinitudes sentience she spread. Infinity was her own natural home. Nowhere she dwelt, her spirit was everywhere. The distant constellations wheeled round her. Earth saw her born. All worlds were her colonies. The greater worlds of life and mind were hers. All nature reproduced her in its lines. Its movements were large copies of her own. She was the single self of all these selves. She was in them, and they were all in her. This first was an immense identity into which her own identity was lost. What seemed herself was an image of the whole. She was a subconscient life of tree and flower, the outbreak of the honeyed buds of spring. She burned in the passion and splendor of the rose. She was the red heart of the passion flower, the dream white of the lotus in its pool. Out of subconscient life she climbed to mind. She was thought and the passion of the world's heart. She was the Godhead hid in the heart of man. She was the climbing of his soul to God. The cosmos flowered in her. She was its bed. She was time, and the dreams of God in time. She was space, and the wideness of his days. From this she rose, where time and space were not. The superconscient was her native air. Infinity was her movement's natural space. Eternity looked out from her on time. End of Canto 7. End of Book 7. Namaste. Jai Ma.